Welcome to Exploration 1, Module 10. All right, first of all, before we get started, as I've said to people before everybody turned on got onto the channel this morning, I should say, you can tell I'm down about 2 hours sleep. The bundle is having some operational issues, which will hopefully be resolved today, and I have some lab rewrites in the pipeline that are going to keep you guys fairly busy. I've already rewritten lab 3.4.1, so if you haven't done lab 3.4.1, there is now a rewritten version complete with a graphics file label set for Sound Recorder if you're running Windows XP. I've never used Sound Recorder under Windows 7, but there people have completed the lab using that. Or you can download an MP3 podcast from Cisco and use that file instead of one you record yourself. But given the fact that everybody here's got microphones, you may want to enjoy recording your own voice. Then again, you might not.
Honestly, it's very easy. What you need to do with Sound Recorder under Windows is press the record button, make your file. It will show up in your My Documents folder, I believe, or My Music, under the title untitled.wma, and it goes 01, 02, 03, untitled, and there you go.
Can't you actually set the file name when you do a save as,
You
or?
can. But if you don't, because it's not something you have to do.
Has anyone else used Sound Recorder under Windows 7? I've never used it under 7, so I wouldn't know.
I have, but I use it only for the assignment, so I don't remember. I think it pops you straight into a file save dialog. It's
Yeah.
ridiculously simple.
It's very easy.
Excellent. Of course, there are far better utilities for recording audio, such as I think there's FreeCorder and RecordPad, and if you actually want to spend money, there's Total Recorder and a whole lot of other things. I'm still not sure about the accessibility of Total Recorder 8, but I am a happy customer of 7.1. So all options for recording stuff with your computer. Now, does anybody? Now, the other thing I've mentioned, which I'll put on the recording, diagram descriptions, I have to put the ones for modules 2 and 3 up, which I have in my inbox. Module descriptions for 4 through 11 are up in HTML format under the HTML subfolder of exam diagram descriptions. If anybody has any problems with the HTML diagram descriptions, can they please get in touch with me? Better late than never, Drew. Oh, don't be like that then. Okay. If anybody has any trouble with the HTML diagram descriptions, can they please drop me a note and we'll try and fix them because I would like to get rid of .doc and supplant them with HTML. There we go. Good morning, Drew. Better late than never. Does anybody have any questions, queries, or things I'd like to ask about before I get started on Chapter 10? Because at the moment, Chapter 10 is a fairly short module. Anything that people want me to go over, review, revisit, all that sort of good stuff. I have had one, well, I've actually had two or three students call me about subnetting. If anybody needs to call me and talk to me about subnetting, I'm on Skype. If you don't have me on Skype by now at work, then we've got problems. And if you need to put me on my home Skype, you can ask me nicely, but be aware that there will be the odd time when I ignore your calls, especially if I'm doing something more exciting at home, than helping students with their subnet. It doesn't happen too often, but it can actually happen. So, does anybody have any queries, questions, and stuff they'd like to raise? Robert asked a question to me yesterday about A plus study guides. I personally have no idea. Does anybody else have any idea as to good A plus study guides that people can get their hands on? It's not something I've had to do. No questions, queries, things anybody wants to ask about?
Well, yeah.
And if you're living under a rock, Australia now apparently has Bookshare. I have no idea what level of access we get to the catalogue. It's probably one of the international knobbly things. Oh, do we? We get better rights than normal international, I'm told, apparently. No. Today, Vision Australia announced that access to Bookshare. It's new today, like this morning. So you can go through them as well. Yeah, so apparently we now have, and you look on bookshare.org and Australia's actually mentioned. So, you little ripper, some books in bizarre formats to read, eh? Now to find something that reads BRFs. Okie dokie. One of these days, I really wish they'd remove that silly thing that says we have to have books in odd, bizarre and strange formats so that blind people are allowed copies of them. That's just really tedious.
Bookshare files are in, I think they have a DAISY format, which is an HTML or XML type format, and they of course have the BRF downloadable type file format.
Yeah, I've used Bookshare content before. DAISY is good for what it is, but often I'm on devices that don't have DAISY readers. And whilst the iPhone does have a very good DAISY reader called DAISY Worm, it doesn't yet do text-only stuff, which means that Bookshare stuff is currently precluded. So we're waiting for those things to be resolved. It'll be some time yet, but text-to-speech for DAISY Worm is being worked on, and DAISY Worm currently reads all of the different audio format books now, including all of the Chinese ones, which took some doing.
Actually, when I get a DAISY file, I open it up and I find the XML file and open it, and it looks like a web page to me. I just read away.
Yeah, Internet Explorer will open most XML. So will Office. So that is certainly another way of getting around it. But yeah, I'm very happy that we have Bookshare over here now for what we can get out of it. It's certainly an exciting development, and it will give us access to more material that we otherwise may not have had access to. Okie dokie. Module 10, cabling a network. Well, I went and I sat down and I read this chapter last night, and I almost fell asleep. And then I took some notes, and then I couldn't go to sleep. But that's neither here nor there. This chapter is basically a rehash of the chapters that preceded it. We will go through the things that are mentioned in it, but it basically appears to be a read-through of a rehash of the previous chapters, which is in itself is not a bad thing. Now... let's see. Close that. Okay. Okie dokie. Do I have my text-to-speech turned on? I do. Oh, good. Okay. Cabling a network. Basically, this chapter talks about what you have to do to make your net work. Yes, we had these silly hubs that once came in this box. I think they were by level 1, and the slogan was making the net work. Okay. Before devices can communicate, you need to plan and cable a network, okay? Plan, okay? Not just drag all the cables out of the packets and run them willy-nilly. Actually have some idea of what you are going to do before you start wandering through the house/office/building with bizarre bits of cable and running them in bizarre manners, okay? So when you are planning a network, and it's possible, it's not very likely that you guys are going to be crawling around in ceiling space doing the cabling. I really can't see. I mean, if you want to do that, nobody's stopping you. There are certain danger aspects of crawling around in ceiling space and stuff that always doesn't make it the safest thing to do. That said, if you want to do it, more power to you. You may, however, be advising people on how to cable networks and what sort of things will and won't work and what sort of best practices should be adhered to, which is why we do this chapter. Has anybody had any official /unofficial experience cabling stuff, like doing their house network or, you know, drilling holes and running the Cat5 and stuff? Has anybody done it?
I've done a little bit of it, not a whole lot. Our network plan isn't real fancy in our...
Ah, so Brian's run lots of cables. Okay. Did you actually have to run them, or did you get
wireless?
Oh, okay. You had some fun with wireless. What did you do, Pranav, with your wireless that was quote fun unquote?
Well, what happened was, it was a home situation where I had to connect my dad's machine to my wireless router, and there was no way that I could drag the router to the middle of the house because the router had to be on the UPS, etc., 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 and you couldn't run cables all over the place. So we had a massive reception issue, which I sort of solved by running an access point for about 100 meters and then getting him a signal. But I had looked at range extenders. I had looked at, I have a Linksys WRT54G. So I had also considered building custom antennas, but then I'm not too mechanically inclined, so I'm not sure how to do all of that.
Fair enough. I know somebody who sort of built up a little parabolic reflector with alfoil was how he used to. One of my friends who lives, I won't say where they live, but essentially for about 6 to 8 months, they were constantly obtaining their internet access at no charge. And they were doing that by using some fairly high-gain antennas and some fairly directional stuff, and he actually had software running on his Linksys WRT54G to crack the web keys and gain his internet access. Now, I would just like to point out that I do not condone that behaviour, and that is a theft of services, and you shouldn't do it, but there are some quite creative people where wireless is concerned. We know of a person who goes on holiday with a directional antenna in his backpack so that he can get online on holidays on unprotected wireless networks.
I found with most cabling, I mean, I can do it and have done it, where you have to go through drop ceilings. And the contractors are way better at me than me, and they're way faster than me. It's just easier to pay a cabling contractor in most cases, to, if you're going to do any significant run.
Absolutely. Now, I don't know if there's anything you can do about it, Brian, but you're very quiet for some reason. And that's not a bad thing, it just means I have to listen really hard. But you may not normalize up on...
Is that much better?
That's much position. Better. Oh, that's much better. Okie dokie. Now, the objectives. Yeah, this was my experience. You can crawl through ceiling spaces, you can run the cable yourself, and if you're doing it at home and stuff, there are actually laws that prevent you from doing the heavy-duty stuff because there is danger involved. But if you're doing sort of a small home network and stuff, you might be able to do it yourself. But seriously, pay somebody else to do it and advise them, because they do lots of cabling and they do it very, very fast. It is theoretically possible for blind people to crimp up cables, and whilst you should see the tools and equipment at least once in your life and see how it's actually done, I usually find that the local electronics store /eBay/ a sighted friend does a far better job at crimping up cables than I do. So it's not a case of loss of independence, it's a case of using the resources you have available to you. Anybody else have anything they wish to add before we move on to the chapter objectives and all that sort of good stuff? Okay. Apparently, by the end of this chapter, I love these chapter examples. They basically tell you all these amazing things that you should be able to do by the end of the chapter. I don't know how many of the things people can actually do by the end of the chapter, but there's the list anyway. Identify the basic media needed to make a LAN connection. Well, that's pretty important. Identify the various types of connections for intermediate and end devices. That's probably a good idea. Identify the pinouts for straight through and crossover cables, or at least know what they are or where to Google them up. Identify the different cabling types, standards, and ports used for wide area network connections. And define the role of device management connections used for Cisco equipment. Design an addressing scheme for an intranetwork and assign addresses for hosts, routers, printers, etc. I think people have done that last one before. Compare and contrast the importance of network designs. Okay. Now, in a LAN, the workstations are generally connected onto the LAN using hubs or switches. Generally speaking, these days we use switches unless, of course, we have a specific need to be able to monitor traffic, or we are on such a budget that you wouldn't believe how much money we need to save. And yes, I have done projects like that where you're wiring up, a network for the local community group, and the budget is zero. Okay, if that's the case, you might actually have a situation where you may want to use hubs or somebody's old 10 megabit switch that you found in their basement. Everybody done those sorts of jobs before, where you get all the bits of hardware you can lay your hands on and hammer something together?
Yep.
Pretty much.
Okie dokies. Now, routers connect networks together, okay? So a router, can anybody tell me at what layer, and you can either say it or type it into chat, depends on how lazy you're feeling, at what layer in the OSI reference model are routers generally considered to operate?
Three.
Although Cisco argues 2, 3, and 4, because Cisco reckons that you've got 2 for the ARP and the physical, like the network layer link stuff, because for the Ethernet, you've got 3 for the IP addresses and that sort of stuff, and then you've got 4 for the network address translation. But 3, I will accept 3, but Cisco argues 2, 3, 4. Okay, the type of router that you need is defined by the type of router that you need to interconnect the network. Yes. You'd think that would be pretty obvious, but it's not. My brother went to a computer store, and my brother was very clear with the salesman and said that he had Big Pond Cable, which is a sort of cable service you get over here if you're really unlucky, and that he wanted a router to connect to Big Pond Cable, and it needed to do this, this, and this. And the bloke sold him a router, and he took it home and rang his brother, and we discovered that the router would not do at all what he wanted it to. And the next day he took the router back to the shop and told the fellow who had sent it to him, sold it to him, that the router did not have the necessary features to perform the task that he wanted to do. Now, I'm going to digress a bit, not that I ever do that, and I'm going to talk about, you've got this wired network and you suddenly want to add wireless to it. Anyone been here? This wireless stuff's sort of starting to sound pretty cool and you think you're going to add it in.
A few years.
Yeah.
One of the things people do. Okay, there's a couple of things you've got to be aware of here. The first thing you've got to be aware of is what you've got. That sounds a bit silly, but you've got to be aware of what router you have and what its capabilities are. This is surprisingly common that people have no idea about this bit of their network. Now, I meant to ask you, Drew, we were talking about this a couple of weeks ago. You absolutely love and enjoy two-wire, don't you? The two-wire range of networking equipment.
Yes, they're my favorite.
Oh, we were talking about that, yeah, with somebody whose router just kept randomly dying. It was a two-wire.
Really? That's so shocking, because they make such reliable and well-put-together equipment.
All right. Now, one of the problems you have with adding wireless to a network...
I hate you.
I just thought I'd mention that, because Grace wasn't sure that you actually had the immense dislike for two-wire that I do. That said, there is the occasional chance when you have a two-wire device that just works flawlessly. It's a bit like winning the lottery. It's not that common, but it can happen. Okay, now... Yeah, pretty much. So if you have... a lot of people have a router, and you've got to figure out... Well, you as the network consultant, for example, need to find out what their router is doing. How many machines do they have on their network? What is performing the network address translation? And what are the capabilities of that router? Because what a lot of people do is they have their ISP configured router. They then buy like a 5-port wireless, you know, Bang Plus router that's got four LAN ports, one WAN port, and a wireless access point. And they then run a cable from their ISP modem to their wireless access point thingy, and it doesn't work very well. Does anybody know, in the default configurations of most of this gear, what could be happening? And if you don't know, I'll tell you all the answer in a minute.
IP address conflict. I think both of these things are at 192.168.1.1.
That's so one thing that can go wrong.
You're actually double matting, because you're, most of these ISP modems will give you a sort of, you typically a Class C address, which if you plug into the WAN port of your router, will then create another, potentially the same subnet, or potentially another one, probably also Class C. So you're going through two layers of NAT, and it gets all weird and funny. I've actually worked around this many times by just ignoring the WAN port and giving the LAN port on the router a static IP, and away you go. It becomes an access point and not a router.
That's exactly right. Anybody else got any other things that might go wrong, just in case anybody's thought of anything else? But they were the two main ones I was after. Okay, so, and the other thing you've got to keep in mind is that if you wire these things together by their LAN ports, as Brian has suggested, which is a very good idea, only have, unless you have configured them to cooperate, which is not usually possible, only have one device doing DHCP. One. Because nothing is worse than having two devices handing out DHCP addresses left, right, and center, and you're not sure which device is giving you the DHCP address, especially if the two devices are actually on separate subnets. So that one time you boot up your PC and it's on one subnet, and one time you boot up the PC it comes up on another set subnet. Let me tell you, that's a good way to not have file sharing work on your home network. Or the internet not work very well either. One of the questions people might ask me is, how are you to know what sort of router you have and what it can do? Read the book. If you haven't bought it yet, and in 90% of the cases you probably already have, well, not you guys, because you're all smarter than that, it also helps to read the box. What does the router actually have? What can the router actually do? What we actually have... is what I've actually gone to doing is I've actually gone to buying specific access points, which basically have one LAN port and then they've got wireless on the other side of them. They're called an UltraWAP, and they're put together over here in Australia, and they're insanely good. You can get a 200 milliwatt version, and it's got the power. There is far better gear, but I'm just talking about in-house stuff. And I use those for my wireless network because they're far reliable than the embedded access points in a lot of the home routers. Has anybody had trouble with the access points in some home routers, like as far as signal reliability and connection stability? I certainly have. Maybe I'm the only one here who's ever had that.
No, I had trouble.
I don't drop that
in the sense that with...
Sorry, Pranav.
Sorry, Alex. Go ahead.
That was actually Rich that was talking.
Oops, sorry.
That's okay. No, I'm saying I've had occasional problems with mine every now and then. There is no specific pattern to it, but maybe once every 2 weeks or so, it'll cut out on me.
It's not too bad.
My problem was I couldn't punch through all the concrete in the house to get to a room which was something like 300 meters away. And that you know, you would get two bars of a signal, and I tried all these weird things like repositioning the antenna on the internal wireless card and stuff like that. But of course, none of that really worked. So the funny thing was, at night, let's say after 6 p.m., the machine in the other room could connect to the internet. It was slow, but it could connect. In the mornings, from sunrise till 6 p.m., no connection.
Interesting. The other easy way of doing this, and it's something that isn't really talked about a lot, but the devices, they're a little bit pricey, but they tend to work, is Ethernet over power lines, which is really cool. You plug one into a wall socket somewhere, and you plug another one into a wall socket somewhere else, and you get a couple of hundred megabits full duplex over the power lines. And that is how you can actually get a network signal out to a far-reaching room in your house, provided it's all on the same power circuit, without actually having the wireless have to reach that far.
The only problem with that is it works on 110 volts, if that's your power supply. It doesn't work with 220, at least the last time I checked that was the case.
No, I've got ones that work on 220. You can actually get 220 volt versions, because I've got a set of them over here in Australia, and we're probably at about 248, actually. We're fairly high volts
over
here.
Yeah, we're on 230, but...
Okay, so anyway, so I do digress, but it is important to understand that when you're planning networks and stuff, that you understand what the networking equipment actually does, what it's actually going to do, and how you're going to hook it together. Because I think you'll find in a lot of cases, sometimes they're really handy and sometimes they're not, but generally speaking, your ISP will only support the routers they supply, which makes a bit of sense because, I mean, the tech monkeys on the phones aren't usually that good, except for, and the other thing that will happen is that they will only support a certain number of computers connecting officially. What I have found is that is to save help desk time. I remember when the Telstra guy came over and I sort of said, oh, according to your terms and conditions, you people only support one PC. But I'm wondering if I go into the CLI of this router whether we can actually set up more than that. And he sort of went, oh, yeah, you'll be fine, because you know what you're doing. It's just the people who don't know what they're doing, and we don't want the phone people sitting around for hours on end getting these people up and running. This was before NAT was a big deal. This was back in about 2000. So be aware that your ISP will not always hold your hand on all of your network configuration. In fact, quite often they won't. Okie dokie. This hasn't goaded off yet. Ah, there it goes. Good. So obviously you have to be careful with that. I would strongly recommend that if you're going to be setting this up that you have access to the manuals of the equipment that you're working with. I'm not going to go into a long discussion about how we access PDF documents. That could be a social chat. But I will summarize by saying Adobe Acrobat, PDF to TXT, Nuance PDF Converter, ABB Wi-Fi Reader, QuartzFile 1000, the Mac, dump the PDF into GIF files and then run it through your favorite OCR. Whatever you have to do to get that PDF stuff out, do it. And whether you love or hate PDF, and most people I have spoken to do not enjoy PDF a lot, I would strongly recommend you guys get good at accessing them, because a huge percentage of manuals for networking equipment and stuff will be in PDF files. So there's no point complaining about it. Just get on with accessing them. Anybody got any other innovative ways of accessing PDF documents? I think I've covered the main ones. Alrighty. So we're saying that switches are preferred over hubs because they break up the network into microsegments and you end up breaking up the collision domain into smaller sections and you get bandwidth per port and the whole network runs a lot more efficiently than if you were using hubs. In fact, getting your hands on hubs in 2010 is quite a challenge. Networking hubs I'm talking about here, not USB hubs. Actually, which brings me to an interesting point, which I'm not going to dwell on, but has anybody noticed that when you get really, really cheap USB hubs and you plug a 1.1 device into your USB hub, the whole hub falls to 1.1? Everybody seen that?
I have it on good authority that it happens, but I've never actually seen it, I don't think.
Yeah, it depends on the hubs, and you do sometimes have this happen. If you plug in a badly behaved 1.1 device, it will tend to pull a lot of the hub down to 1.1. Now, this can also be true for multi-mode hubs. If you've got hubs that do 10/100 and stuff, you would be better to use a switch because the switch will handle the differences in speeds. Although, to be honest with you, has anybody here still got any 10 megabit gear? I think I've got three network cards in a box somewhere that still got 10 megabits per second, but I think it's pretty rare for anybody to still have 10 megabits per second gear. This is Ethernet.
I saw them in school, but after that, no.
Okie dokie. Now, the factors you should be considering. The cost. That's always very important. I don't think I really need to go into that. I think we all understand what cost is. The speed and the types of ports and interfaces. This can be important, actually. If you are trying to save money, see the cost point, and you've got 7 machines and you've bought an 8-port hub because you can't afford the 16-port hub or switch or whatever, it's important that you understand that a lot of hubs and switches have a port at the end that can either be set as a standard port or can be set as an MDIX port. In other words, it can have the crossover logic applied to it for connecting hubs and switches together. One of the interesting things I found, and it's going away pretty much today because they're mostly auto-detect these days, is that a lot of 9-port hubs actually have 8 usable ports, and it's usually port 8 or 9 that you can use where 9 is MDIX or crossed over and 8 is a straightforward port. You can't use 8 and 9 at the same time. So if you have a device like this and it's got an odd number of ports like 9 or 17, find out what all the ports do and find out which ones can be used because sometimes it's one or the other. Other devices have a button that let you flick between straight through and crossover, and some of them auto-detect. In fact, a lot of laptops now auto-detect as well. Okay, the other things you've got to consider are expandability and manageability. Now, the manageability is an interesting one. I used to buy regular unmanaged switches, gigabit switches for about $50-$60. But I found some really cheap Linksys managed switches for about $100 a throw, and they've got things like bandwidth control and link aggregation and MAC tables and stuff like that. And I actually found that having managed switches made things a lot nicer because I could actually go through and look at which speeds all of the ports were running out and figure out which machines were connected onto which ports and all that sort of stuff. So sometimes a little bit of management can go a long way, and sometimes it's not much more expensive than the unmanaged stuff if you're going for the simple stuff. And additional features and services. So what bells and whistles does it have that you might actually want to use in your network? Okay, any questions on any of that so far, or is this all pretty straightforward? I'm finding it pretty straightforward myself, but you guys might have some questions.
I was curious about the auto-detection, because in this chapter they talk about the pin arrangements and so on, so how does that all work?
Ian's not here, is he?
No, why?
Okay. No, I just wanted to know how the auto-detection worked on those ports, but it doesn't matter. You know, when you get auto detecting hubs, Pranav was asking how the auto detection actually worked, but I don't know. No, I got no idea either. Righto. Try Wikipedia. There's probably a chip that actually looks at what comes in on the port, figures out what polarity the signal is, and then makes a decision on the chip as to how to switch them over. I'm not exactly sure of how the algorithm works, but I know there is a pre-link pulse that it can look at, and depending on the polarity of that pulse and stuff, it can figure out which are the transmit pins and which are the receive pins.
Okay, I'll search around.
I think if you actually look at N-way auto negotiation would be a search term I would be using. It will tell you about the pre-link pulses and stuff, which may allow you to figure out how that works. So I will also ask Ian when he comes back at some point. All right, anybody else got any questions, comments before we continue on? Feel free to type no into chat, guys, because that will stop me from pausing, which doesn't show up in the recording, but it makes your time go slower. Whilst having one big switch, like getting one big 48-port switch, might be cheaper, as in cost per port, sometimes the length of the cable runs can preclude doing that, especially if the lengths of the cables that you're running from the switch are longer than 90 to 100 meters. So you might actually want a number of smaller switches because the cable length restriction starts again at each switch. If a switch fails, a network can go down. This happens. I went away on holidays, a very short story, this was back in 2003. I went to Melbourne for holidays. The girl that was going to be my wife rang me up and said, I've had enough of my parents, can I move into your house? And I said, well, I'm in Melbourne, but I guess so. And she moved in and there was no internet whatsoever. So she had to resort into plugging her modem into the wall socket and using the modem rather than the network I had in. And when I got back from Melbourne, I actually discovered that my main switch that connected all my servers had blown up. And that was, all of the servers were, you know, responding and the network interfaces and stuff were up and stuff, but there was no switch, so therefore there was no connectivity to the rest of the house. So, yes, you can have switches fail. Especially if they're D-Link, in my experience. I had a couple of the power supplies go bang and all of the smoke came out. I think they've tidied those up now, but some of the ones back in 03 were a bit dicey. You can either have multiple links between different switches, so you can have two links between two switches. In fact, you can do this with the Linksys switches I've got. You can actually have two 1 gigabit connections between the two switches to have a 2 gig uplink. And you can also have multiple switches, but that can be somewhat expensive. The other thing you've got to keep in mind is if you can, and you've got... Go ahead.
Okay, quick digression. But I have had my DSL modem router go bang more than once. No smoke, it would simply stop working. And what we discovered was these things look the same, they feel the same, they work the same, the interface is the same, but their power requirements are subtly different. So whenever the ISP would come and change my DSL modem router, they would just give me their box, the router box, and walk away. They should have also given me the power supply to go with it.
Nasty. Well, that's bad service on their part, because the... Well, it depends. I mean, I noticed, for example, when I sent back in, I had some Netgear routers that misbehaved on me, some switches that did some really odd things and became really unreliable, and I could never track down the problem. You're off, apparently. You have no idea how the auto detect on the MDI/MDIX works, Pranav was asking. Okay. If you find out, can you let them know at some point? Because Pranav's curious to know how that auto detects, you being the engineer and all that sort of stuff. It's not critical, so if you can't be bothered, that's okay, but yeah. Right. Ian will have a look. Yeah, that's all right. Ian will have a look, and if he finds it at some point, he'll tell us all how it works. Yeah, anyway, so when you send stuff back to Netgear, they tell you not to send the power supplies back. So I did the advance replacement product thing where I actually paid the money to send me switches first and then they were going to bill my credit card if I didn't actually send the other ones back. And I didn't actually have to send the power bricks down, so I've got a whole stack of spare 12-volt 1-amp supplies from Netgear, which I think I can use for propping doors open and all sorts of other interesting things because they're those big transformer 12-volt 1-amp supplies. The other thing they're saying in this note, best to plan for a little expansion so that if you add more machines in, you don't have to go and buy more switches, okay? So if you've got 10 machines, you might want to buy, say, for example, 2 8-port switches if the machines are separated, or you may want to buy the 16-port switches instead of the 8-port switches if your budget will support that. If the switches are smart enough to have this...
I was at a client recently, and he's in the construction business, okay? So they keep getting projects, and they keep adding people to the office, they keep adding offices. So I asked him, do you have a capacity management process? And he said, no, because I could probably do it for my servers, but... what do I do for my clients? And for the client systems, and I didn't really have a good answer for him, because you could get 2 projects, you could get 1 mega project, and you could get a bunch of small projects which don't require any addition at all to the network. So, I mean, what is the answer for such a situation, especially when it comes to planning switches and things like that?
Well, I think it would be fair to say that if your switches were at 100% capacity, so you had 8 PCs plugged into an 8-port switch, that is technically potentially a bad situation because you have no capacity to uplink to another switch without unhooking one of the cables. So I would tend to buy the switches one bigger than what I needed if I had the budget to do it, so that I had a few extra ports to be able to wire things in. Otherwise, you've got to figure out which machine you're going to rip out of the switch so that you can plug in the uplink cable and then plug the other switch into the other machine into another switch, which means disruption of services. So I think what they're saying here is a lot of people are in the habit of buying exactly what they need, and especially if you come from this state, for example, a lot of people aren't interested in spending out any extra money. But what they're saying here in the notes is that if you spend out a little bit extra in the short run, maybe $20, $30 or $40 or whatever, you then have infinitely more expandability than you would if you hadn't spent the money out, especially if you're dealing with the high-end gear, where the ability to have management cards might be an extra $100, but if you don't bother with that, you're stuck with a situation where you can't expand and then you've got to replace the entire switching infrastructure. So it's just a bit of common sense, and you buy a little bit more extra capacity if you can afford it, and then when the new projects come along, you put in new switches and stuff that way, but at least you've got the ports to be able to uplink to them.
Okay.
The other thing you've got to concern yourself with, how many ports are needed at what speed? In other words, are you going to run gigabit to the desktop, like my house? Or you're going to be more realistic and run 100 megabit to the desktop and have managed switches and have the servers running at a gigabit and then having the workstations run at 100 megabit. Keep in mind that if you're running gigabit infrastructure, you need Cat5e, Cat6 or Cat7 cabling. If you have Cat5 cable, it might work, but it's probably not going to be good enough. So make sure your cabling is adequate for what you're running. If you are running 100 megabit Ethernet, you only need 2 of the 4 pairs connected, 1 and 2, 3 and 6. And this bit a lot of people because a lot of people had 1 and 2, 3 and 6 used for Ethernet, and they had 4 and 5, 7 and 8 used for the internal phone system. And weren't they upset when Gigabit came out and used all of the 4 pairs? So watch out for that. Okay, so that's something to be aware of. And if you're going to do a cabling job, put in the highest category of cable you can afford in your cabling budget, so that because recabling a building is a very costly exercise. You can run stuff back through the raceways and stuff, but it's not a lot of fun to do it. So best to put the best cable you can afford in at the time that you are cabling the network. Now they're talking about routers. They're saying modular routers are routers that allow you to add interfaces cards. This is usually pretty expensive. In fact, Cisco is renowned for being mind-bogglingly expensive for Wix cards and stuff. So you need to be aware of what your expansion options are, what sort of interfaces you can add to the router and how much it's going to cost you. The operating system type governs features on the router. Has anybody come across any of those inaccessible let's refresh once every second web interfaces on certain home ISP routers? Yeah, they're not a lot of fun. And sometimes it can be quite difficult to find out whether the interface is any good. So you do run a risk of either having to turn off the page refreshes, or I've found some pretty nasty ones that have sort of unlabeled graphics and stuff. So it can certainly be a challenge to get the ones that are actually behave themselves. That said, I've actually found a lot of the D-Link stuff has a Telnet interface, and the Telnet interface is really good, or even an SSH interface. There's also a whole lot of gear by a mob called Open Networks, and they run Linux inside their routers, and I remember ringing up the ISP and asking them for the password for the command line interface. And I said, this looks like a Linux box. What's the password? And he's like, oh, it's 0p3n. I'm like, oh, who was on LeakSpeak today? And he's like, the username's not admin. I said, no, the username's root. And then you log in and do what you need to do. He's like, ah, okay, you obviously dealt with some of these before. And they're a nifty router that had a Linux shell in them that you could do all sorts of diagnostics and stuff from. So sometimes you win and sometimes you lose as far as the router interfaces are concerned. Anybody got any comments before I move on to the next section? Jolly good. Cabling. These are the things you've got to consider. And the work area. So the work area is where your PCs and stuff sit. Now, in professional cabling, you're going to be dealing with punch-down tools, you're going to be dealing with wall jacks, you're going to be dealing with wall plates, and you're going to be dealing with patch leads that drop from the wall panel down to the computer. This is probably a small point, but often in a lot of office installations that haven't sort of migrated to voice over IP, because voice over IP can be really good and it can be really bad. And if you have bad network infrastructure, the voice over IP calls can be really bad because you lose bits of phone conversation and all sorts of nastiness. Or it can be running at G.729 and sound absolutely horrible. But a lot of offices actually have two ports, one for the network and one for the phone system, and some phone systems run on RJ45, so it's important that if you're cabling this sort of stuff up, make sure you know which ones are the network ports and which ones are the phone ports. Okay, the telecommunication... Sorry?
With voice over IP, don't you only need network ports? I mean, why would you need a phone port at all?
You don't need a network port with voice over IP, you don't need a phone port with voice over IP, which was my point. But I was saying, for those companies that haven't moved to voice over IP because of the quality of service issues and stuff. And in fact, if you ever want to hear really bad voice over IP, and I hope they've fixed it by now, call up Linksys, who's now owned by Cisco, and get some tech support from Linksys over their voice over IP links. It sounds horrific. Sadly, we also have a lot of voice IP installations from your country of origin, Pranav, that sometimes call me around dinner time trying to sell me things, and their voice over IP quality is usually quite bad. No reflection on current company, of course, but they're in the same geography as you guys.
I know. They annoy me too. I don't lunch.
Yes, exactly. They probably ring you up too. I'm sure you don't escape from them. But yes, sometimes their voice over IP is very bad. I don't know whether anybody's noticed. Has anybody ever been on a voice over IP connection where there's about a second to a second and a half delay, and you sort of, you know, you feel like you're taking a nostalgic trip back to the 80s making international calls over the satellites?
My work phone is almost permanently like that.
Ah, okay. Is there any reason why the voiceover IP hasn't been prioritized above the other network traffic, or is that just the base latency in the network full stop and there's nothing you can do about it?
We're running on 10 or 11-year-old NEC gear that wasn't designed to actually run over the Internet. It was sort of their first implementation of VoIP that was designed to go in an office, not over the Internet. And our reseller was horrible and basically said, we made this work in your office, now you're on your own to figure it out. Unfortunately, I never go to the office. And we have some old gear, like our switches are pretty old. And I actually did set QoS up, and it made a little bit of difference. It's a bit better than it was, but it's still, I think it's just some really old gear using a funny protocol. It's not SIP, because otherwise I would just set it up on, you know, one of my ATAs here, and I don't know how to fix it, and because it's NEC proprietary gear through a reseller, no one will help me.
Fair enough. Can't argue that. But yeah, I was just curious to know, you know, I assumed you had looked into it, but yeah, and I think the thing you've got to keep in mind, and there are a lot of companies, this is a general point, that are looking at putting in voice over IP due to the cost savings and stuff, you've got to make sure that the network infrastructure is geared up to take that, that you have the necessary quality of service, that you have a low enough latency to make this viable, and you also have enough infrastructure in so that when the internet goes down, the entire phone system for the company doesn't go down. And in fact, when the internet goes down here, so does the phone system. And that is often not a good thing. So that's something you need to keep in mind. We've all played with voice over IP, we've all played with Skype, some of us with iThings have Heytel, and PingChat is another one apparently. Is it Chat PingChat or Chat Ping? I can't remember what it is. There's another application that does it. All sorts of nifty things over voice over IP. Quite cool, work fairly well, but you've got to have the underlying systems working, otherwise you can have some very upset people struggling making business calls and stuff. It only requires a little bit of jitter and packet drop for people to become very unhappy with the phone systems. Now, none of that had anything to do with the lecture, but hey. Okay, so the telecommunications room, also known as the distribution facility. That is where all of your cables come together and they all come into the patch panels and you've got all of the switches and stuff. And if they're funky switches, they've usually got fans and stuff in them and they're quite noisy, and if you're lucky, the room that all this stuff is in is air conditioned so that it all doesn't cook. Some people also put the servers into the telecommunications center. Sometimes they put them in racks in the same room, and sometimes they put them in other places depending on the layout of the business. The next thing that we talk about is backbone cabling, which is also known as the vertical cabling. That is what you use to connect the telecommunications centres together. And it's usually high bandwidth, sometimes fibre, sometimes high bandwidth copper. If it's fibre, you tend to use that. If you're doing it between buildings, you tend to use fibre to avoid lightning strikes and stuff, because lightning strikes usually do a number on your switches, and it's not safe to run copper long distances between buildings. Anybody who's done any RF work has probably heard of their coax being hit by lightning and it frying various things. It can happen. Or if your aerial gets hit, that will tend to singe things. You've then got the distribution cabling, which is also known as your horizontal cabling, which is the cabling that runs from the telecommunications center to the wall jacks where your PCs happen to be. Now, note that the limit of the cabling is, generally speaking, 100 meters per run of UTP, which the TIA/IEEE recommend that you run 90 meters from your comm center to your to your wall jacks. You have 5 meters to drop from your PCs to your wall, and then you have another 5 meters that goes from the switches to the punch down panels in the communications center. So they're the TIA recommendations. You can get away with cable length runs longer than this, but it is not stable, reliable, recommended, or a good idea. so try not to do it. Okay, I'm just scanning my notes because I've already talked about some of this. Okay, when choosing media, consider the cable length. Is it going from room to room or building to building? This is somewhat important. Cost. Does the budget allow us to use a more expensive cable type or a better type of cable? There is a note in ITE1, although I think they pulled it out. There are rules and requirements, I believe, in America that state that any cabling run in raceways in buildings needs to be plenum grade, which precludes the use of PVC insulation. I think that's correct. Did somebody mention that a few weeks back?
Yes, that is correct. There are cable in walls. There's a bunch of funny rules, but there's the cable in the walls and the plenum. You know, has to be plenum grade cable. It's Teflon coated Teflon cable, and other cable can be a PVC cable. And I think they allow PVC cable if it's encased in a metal conduit.
The reason for this, and you may wonder what the reason for these laws is that if you have lots of PVC, and especially if you have lots of cables running in raceways and there's a fire, the actual fumes from the PVC burning will actually kill people more effectively than the fire itself. So that's the reasoning behind those sorts of laws. You don't want people dropping dead from the fumes of the burning PVC jacketing on your network cable. Okay, the other thing you've got to consider is bandwidth. Are you going to have enough bandwidth, and how much traffic are you going to shovel through these particular cables, and what speed are you going to run them? If you've got a lot of network traffic, you might want to be looking at, you know, 1 gig, 10 gig fiber. You might even want to run a lot of fiber if you're going to put fiber in to begin with, because let's face it, if you're going to go to the bother to run fiber, it's often cheaper to run 10, 20, 30 fibers and have, you know, 15 of them dark than it would be to just run the two fiber optic pieces and then have to rerun it at a later date. How easy is it to install this stuff? Are your people going to be able to install it, or are you going to have to call some sort of contractor to install it for you? How much EMI/RFI are you going to have? This can be important in industrial situations where you've got electric motors. It can be also important if you've got fluorescent lighting. Running your network cable over the top of your lighting ballasts is probably not a good idea, because you're going to get a hell of a lot of interference from the fluoro cabling. If you're running fluoro lights, I should say. The other thing you've got to keep in mind is if you're running wireless, do you have any other interference systems in the same area that are going to cause problems? And I know for a fact that a lot of, just as a matter of interest, a lot of hospitals forbid you from using mobile phones and stuff inside the hospital, because there's a fear that they will interfere with the life support equipment and stuff. This is probably true, and it probably has happened, although we did have to have a bit of a chuckle when we went into hospital and it was no use of mobile phones, but there was a D-Link wireless access point stuck on the wall. So I'm not quite sure.
Fantastic.
How that
works. I think it's more of a rational fear of cell phones.
No, there are actually cases of mobile phones interfering with equipment, and if there is any chance of you interfering with life support equipment and you kill somebody, you are so very liable. I think that's probably where it comes from, and they probably don't want to take the risk.
I find that some of those policies seem to be more relaxed now these days.
They're better than what they were, and there is a lot of change. I think, actually, I haven't actually seen the episode, although I've probably got the entire series at home, so I'll have to dig through them and find out which episode it is. Apparently Mythbusters mythbusted the mobile phones on aeroplanes thing.
They just say that because they actually want to make it a quieter, more enjoyable flight for people now, is really more of the reason.
I think the other problem is, there's another point that needs to be put in there too, is that if you're busy talking on your mobile, you might not be paying attention to emergency broadcasts going over the plane system as well, which is another reason why they don't want you on your phone. And knowing some of the people I know and how they glue the phone to their head, that is a valid concern, because they will be going glub, glub, glub in the drink while everybody else has got off the plane because they're still on the phone. And also, I mean, how many people want people on a mobile sitting next to you on the flight talking all the way from A to B? That would sort of get on my nerves, but other people might not find it anywhere near as much of a problem.
Especially when so many people actually yell when they talk on their cell phones.
Yes, yes, it's very important that you yell, because, I mean, the mobile phone doesn't have the capacity to get your voice from point A to point B. You have to yell to help it along. It's just one of these things that people subconsciously do, that, yeah, it annoys me. Okay, the other thing is you need to be careful with, and don't even get me started about blind people on mobile phones walking down corridors not paying attention to which direction they're going. Okay, moving right along. Holding cups of coffee, right. Cables usually run in raceways. And you have to be careful with raceways, especially if you're dealing with optical fiber, because the bends in optical fiber, if they are too extreme, will stop the light from going down the fiber, and that is obviously a bad thing. So make sure the person that is installing your fiber knows what they are doing. Wireless networks have less cables. Funny that. I sort of read that back this morning and went, yeah, what a dumb statement. But hey, they do have less cables. But EMI is a problem. You need to be aware of anything on the band that's going to be causing you problems. Is the microwave in the establishment badly shielded? Is it going to mess the wireless networks up? Yes, it has happened. And seriously, if your microwave is messing up your wireless network, I would suggest you get your microwave checked, because that is so very dangerous. Or, you know, are there baby monitors that the wireless network makes a mess of? Are your cordless phones interfering with your wireless? There's a lot of 2.4 gigahertz cordless phone gear that messes around with the wireless. And if you have a nominal wireless signal and cordless phones, shutting off the cordless phones can make the difference between having a signal and not having one. I've seen that happen a few times. Any questions / comments before we continue? Yay! Okay. It's all right, Alex. The world doesn't get any better. This is a big sigh from one of our local students. The RJ45 is specified by the EIA/TIA. The pins are numbered from 8 to 1 when the cables are viewed from the front, and they are numbered from 1 to 8 if the open gate is facing you. No, that's somebody going out to the loo. The T568A and the T568B pinouts are in your notes. I'm not going to sing the cable pin song because I don't have the pinouts in front of me, but you can refer to the cable building exercise of 2007. Does anybody know whether I've copied the cable making stuff into the exploration folder, or is it not there yet? I haven't actually looked. Has anybody seen it there, or do I need to symlink it in?
I didn't see it there. I really wasn't looking for it, but I don't remember seeing anything there like that.
Okay, it's possible I haven't simlinked it in, so what I'll do is I'll simlink that in. There's some audio labs where we build cables, and we test cables, and our esteemed fearless leader, Ian, makes some broken cables, and we test them and find out what's wrong with them. So I'll simlink that in, and you guys can have a listen to that, especially if you're curious as to how the cables go together, because it's all quite well described, and you hear people crunching the cables down and stuff. It's, well, we think it was fairly well done. Okay, so the T568A is your regular straight-through pinout. Well, technically it's one pinout, and then the T568B is the other pinout. If you put T568A on both ends of a cable, or you put T568B on both ends of a cable, it is a straight through cable. A straight through cable is used for connecting a workstation to a switch, And there's a whole lot of other things that it's used for, and I'll go through those as we get further down into the notes, because I did put them in here. If you have T568A on one end of the cable and T568B on the other end, you have a crossover cable. That is to say, pins 1 and 2 are wired to 3 and 6 on one end, and pins 3 and 6 are wired to 1 and 2 on the other end. A crossover cable is used for connecting PCs together. Without staring significantly at the end of the cable, it is not always easy to tell which cable is which, straight through or crossover. So either have the cables of a specific colour, or mark your crossover cables with a couple of cable ties in some sort of pattern that you'll recognise, so that you can tell which ones are the crossovers and which ones are the straight throughs. There are cable testers that are fairly cheap that do wire map. In other words, they'll tell you what wires are connected to what with a series of LEDs. It may be possible to use a light probe or similar to actually read off those LEDs and find out how the cables are wired. I haven't actually tried it, but there are actually some cable testers that do have 8 LEDs, and it would be possible to read those off. Okay, here we go. Use straight-through cables for connecting. And usually there's a question in this on your test. Switch to router. Computer to switch. Computer to hub. Okay, that's what you use your straight-through cables for. Use crossover cables for switch to switch, switch to hub, hub to hub, router to router, and computer to computer. Question: if two computers have one network card apiece, how many computers can you connect together with a crossover cable?
Two.
Two is correct. Well done.
I thought it was some kind of special trick question or something. I'm like, that's so easy, it can't be the right
answer. I was successful. Okay.
I don't recall you mentioning the computer to router is also connected with a crossover cable, since a router is a computer.
No.
Computer to router is connected with a...
straight through cable.
No, it depends on the router, Grace. If it's a Cisco router, it is actually a crossover from computer to router, but generally speaking, you run computer to switch. But yes, he is correct. Computer to router is technically done with a crossover cable if it's Cisco gear. We're talking about routers, not the ones with the integrated switch that you're used to.
Okay.
Most equipment these days, however, is MDI, MDIX auto crossover. And you can reconfigure the ports and stuff, but if you've got the old Cisco crusty gear that doesn't do that, you do need to be aware of how those are wired. The answer in the exam, that question is not asked anymore, Alex. Yeah, Alex would say, he would say straight and get it wrong. They don't ask that particular question in the answer. But you've got to understand that if you're connecting to a router, you're not connecting to a switch. You are connecting to a router, okay? If you're connecting to a router with an integrated switch, you are connecting to a switch. Therefore, you'd use a straight through. But if you are connecting to a router, you would use a crossover. I thought I did mention it. Here it is. Use crossover cables for switch to switch, switch to hub, hub to hub, router to router, computer to computer, computer to router. There we go. Yeah, it's there. Okay, I've talked about the auto MDI, MDIX crossover, so we won't talk about that again. So it's either a button, a switch, or auto detect, or something else. If it's really nasty, it's a dip switch. Okay, DCE and DTE. DCE is data communications equipment. It is responsible for providing the clock signal on WAN links. Generally speaking, unless you are setting up both ends of the communications equipment, the DCE is at your provider end, because the provider is going to set the clock, because that shows how much they're going to bill you. The faster the clock, the more they bill you. DTE is data terminal equipment at the client end. When you're actually simulating the connections between two routers, which is what we've got in the remote bundle, you use a V.35 link with two smart serials on either end, and it has a female and male connector in the middle. I think it's a 15-pin connector. The female end of that cable is the DCE. And the only way I tell people how to remember that is females have children, so DCE. And it also has the clock. Whereas the DTE is actually a male connector. Now, you guys, unless you see these particular cables, won't come across them physically, sadly. Although, if you guys happen to want to fly over to Perth and see us, we'd be more than happy to show you those cables. We do actually have cable descriptions, which aren't quite the same, but they are up there where we talk about all the different cables, and we tell people what they look like and what they feel like and all of that sort of thing. So, they will probably be sim-linked into your area later today. Planning how you allocate addresses. I don't think I'm going to go over this again. I'm going to write you all up an exercise to do, and then if you guys get it all wrong, I will go over this again. You want to limit the size of broadcast domains, so that's why you use routers. You also tend to use routers if you've got different administrative divisions and you want to keep the IT people away from everybody else, such as the accountants and the managers and all of that sort of thing. So you put them on different subnets. One of the things I haven't mentioned previously, and it's been on my mind but I haven't quite got around to it, when you have networks with routers on them, each router must have an IP address on the subnet that it is going to connect. So if you've got 30 workstations and a router, you are going to need a subnet that can take 31 IPs, otherwise you won't have enough IPs for the router on that subnet. Any questions on any of that so far? Okay. If you have, if you're going to have a pattern, try and keep the patterns the same across all the subnets because it makes life easier. If the workstations are usually 1 through 64 and the servers are 64 through 96, etc., try and keep that uniform across the subnets. If you have a convention where you have the gateway set to .1, have all the gateways set to .1, or if you've got all the gateways set to .254, have all the gateways set to .254, or whatever you happen to be doing, because it makes things easier. The only final thing I've got to talk about is out-of-band connections, which are console ports. A console port to a router is an RS-232C connection usually, or a serial port, which generally comes out to what we call a rollover cable. A rollover cable has pins 1 through 8 wired through pins 8 through 1, and it's usually a flat cable rather than twisted pair, although you can run rollover over twisted pair if you really want to. It's RS-232 serial. It's usually 9600 N81, although you can change the baud rate on the routers. If you do that, you obviously have to change your terminal software and stuff. Anybody who has accessed either of the remote bundles, either the one at Curtin or the one at the association, you will have used serial ports to talk to the Cisco routers. They are actually connected over the console ports. Console ports do not carry network traffic and are thereby considered an out-of-band connection. Therefore, they can be used for monitoring, password resets, and other things that don't involve the network. You will become more familiar with those as you play with the remote bundle once I actually get the network interfaces up and functional, which I am currently working on. Has anybody got any questions, queries, comments, or anything they would like to add to this lecture before I press the stop button?
Actually, in a lot of these server rooms, there are so many fans, and I'm a little surprised that the courseware hasn't discussed airflow issues, because I know that at least inside a computer, this could be a major issue with heat if your airflow is the wrong way around. It's because if you actually have a fan, you know, sucking in air the wrong way or not pushing out the hot air correctly. Because I've been to an awful lot of server rooms of late, and no one's even talking about this. I don't know why, with all these racks and rack fans, etc., etc., etc.?
I think it's one of those things that you're theoretically supposed to know about, but nobody really talks about too much. It is important, although generally speaking, at this level of the CCNA, apparently you're not supposed to be putting server rooms together, but it does pay to know a bit of common sense about how air is going to be blown, and what direction in which air is travelling, and how you're going to have air conditioning set up, and also the types and capacity and stuff of your fans. It is an important consideration, and it's something that needs to be planned if you are putting server rooms together. Also, I don't know whether anybody's seen a lot of the 1RU gear, which is the stuff that sits in the 19-inch racks that's 1 inch high, but in my experience, a lot of that 1RU gear has exceedingly noisy fans. In fact, we used to have an X-Serve here, which is an Apple server that we were so happy to get rid of because its RAID kept rebuilding itself every 2 days and it was more trouble than it was worth. It had really noisy fans, and in fact our remote bundle has really noisy fans, and I'll be putting a little recording of what it sounds like to power up the remote bundle, just because it's a fun thing to have up on the site, and you'll hear all the fans come up and come online so that you really know that this remote bundle isn't a figment of your imagination. But yes, airflow is important, and there are actually companies such as openxtra.co.uk that specialise in air conditioning, airflow, and thermal dynamics of the server rooms. Server heat dissipation is usually measured in BTU, or British Thermal Units, and you need to make sure that your data room slash center is rated to handle the amount of heat dissipation specified by your servers. Anything else anybody wants to talk about? Just out of morbid curiosity, is everybody enjoying the course so far?
So far.
Yes, and I've used it professionally as well.
Oh, that's good. That's good. That's what we like to hear, because it goes without saying that if you're not enjoying the course, could you please submit some constructive feedback, and we'll see what we can do about it. Because whilst they pay us money to do this, we'd also like you guys to have a good time and learn stuff. Grace is just saying they don't pay her any money, they pay me money. Yes, all right, they pay me money, all right. Hey, you'll be getting some money from somewhere else soon, so I wouldn't complain too much, if all goes well. Alright, you closed out. You're not on the server. Yeah, no, Grace King left the server a little while ago. Okay, anybody else got anything else to add before I hit stop? Oh, okie dokie. Handy hint if you are running a netbook running Windows 7. Make sure you've got all of the drivers installed on it. So, for example, if you have, we've got Asus EEPC 1000HEs, make sure your hard disk is using the Intel-specific drivers, not just the standard AHCI drivers, and make sure you've got all your Intel chipset drivers installed, because it does run so much nicer when you do that. So, there's a little handy hint if you have a netbook with Windows 7. And now I get to press stop.